The Indicator from Planet Money is a daily podcast that helps you make sense of what's happening in the economy. And video games are a growing slice of that economy, with billions of people around the world identifying as gamers. That's why we're dedicating a week-long series to the growing business of video games. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Sam Sanders, and today I'm revisiting one of my favorite conversations, maybe ever, on this show. It's a chat with the one and only Jonathan Van Ness. You might know Jonathan, or JVN as he's called, as a grooming expert on the Netflix makeover show Queer Eye. He is very hard to miss. JVN is this walking, talking bundle of energy and optimism.
It's almost like the reverse of I woke up like this. Like, did anyone ever wake up like this?
If you're as broke as a joke, there's no excuse for you to not have some face wash.
Actually, the way that he is great, and it looks amazing.
So Queer Eye is now in production for its sixth season. And Jonathan, along with the rest of the Fab Five, as they're called, they are up for an Emmy for Best Reality Show Host this year. This whole month, we've been sharing other conversations with other actors and performers up for Emmys this year. So go check out the feed for more if you like. Anyway, in this chat, we talk about Queer Eye and JVN's journey to get to this point in his life and career. It was not easy. JVN writes about all of it in his memoir, which is called Over the Top, A Raw Journey to Self-Love. He talks about childhood trauma, depression, drug use, sexual compulsion, and a lot more. But JVN also writes about how he's dealing with all of it. It's a very inspiring story. Listeners, as a heads up, we get into a lot of stuff that is heavy and sensitive in this chat. May not be the best one for kids to hear. All right, here's my chat with Jonathan Van Ness, JVN. Enjoy. All right, so I want to talk about this book, which I devoured over the weekend. But I got a very specific question to ask about the particular way you wrote this book. It's a memoir, and in a lot of memoirs, people will change the names of family and friends just to protect the family and friends. What you did with this book, and what I loved, is that every name that was changed, you changed it to a very distinctly Russian name, like a classic Russian name. That's kind of amazing.
Thank you. After the animated classic Anastasia, as I talk about in the book, I've never been the same. I've never fully recovered. So that definitely was reflected through the name change choices.
Yeah. And like, it wasn't like just Vladimir and stuff. It was like some deep cut Russian names. Like, what was the most extreme Russian-y Russian name you used to disguise someone?
Well, my favorite name that I use to disguise anyone is a made-up Russian name.
Really?
It's for my figure skating coach, Elliot, and I changed his name to Elliot Skovadova. And I thought I feel like you put Skovadova on something and it just feels so Russian. And I live for a Russian name.
Oh, listen, same here. So this book, I've read it. Some folks that hear this conversation will have read it or will not have read it. Give us a quick elevator pitch for it and what you're trying to say in it in like 30 seconds.
You know, it's kind of like the good, the bad, and the ugly of, you know, kind of what I went through in becoming the JVN that people know a version of, like through Queer Eye or maybe, you know, my Instagram or my podcast or whatever. It's the story of me coming to terms with everything that's kind of happened to me and how I've just kind of navigated to where I am now. And I think that there are definitely things that I discuss in the book that, you know, you may or may not see coming. But I really think that the things that I talk about in the book are important conversations that we need to be having. And yeah.
It was probably in the early chapters in the book where you lay out this kind of analogy as to how you see yourself navigating all the different sides of yourself and, you know, talking about your journey, loving yourself, being nice to yourself. But you describe navigating all the different parts of your personality and emotions as like having to drive a van full of several different JVNs. There's introvert JVN, extrovert JVN, loving JVN, judgy JVN. They're all trying to drive the car. And you have to figure out who gets to be in the driver's seat or the back seat based on what you need. I loved that analogy, and I had never heard it before. Where'd that come from?
Well, I don't think I invented that analogy. I think it is an analogy that is often used in parts therapy, which is a therapy that, you know, I've done and work with my therapist on, And it really helps me to think about, you know, a system of personalities interacting with that way in a car. I do think that I think in that paragraph I talk about, like, what my parts are really doing in the car, which that is my own interpretive flair.
Yeah. What are they doing in the car?
I think I was talking about, like, one was on the roof listening to Lizzo, like, twerking, trying to get my ass to clap on the roof. And the other ones were, you know, trying to get somewhere on time. And the other one was, yeah. But the thing is about parts that's really interesting is that, like, everyone has, like, their own minivan, so to speak, and their own parts to name and give voice to. And that's a really cool thing about parts therapy is that, like, no one can really tell you, like, what your parts are, like, and your relationship with, like, the – and it doesn't – it's – everyone has parts. And
yes.
And I think based on your amount of trauma and your upbringing and kind of what you went through, like, will determine, like, how intense or easily identifiable or, like, polarized your parts will show up in your personality.
Yeah.
And, you know, I definitely have some pretty colorful parts.
You're not telling any of the parts to get out of the van. You're saying, you're part of me, you're me, you get to ride, but we got to work together effectively in this vehicle.
Totally. And I think that's the thing with parts as well, is like they're all doing the best they can with what they know.
Yes.
It's just that sometimes they're, you know, misguided. And also when you have experienced trauma, a lot of times your parts will get stuck in and around the age that you were when you incurred that trauma. So when you're – a lot of times the parts that we're dealing with will be like younger versions of ourselves. And that is a lot of times where people – you know, myself included, like, can really get into trouble because that part is still kind of stuck in an era where it's, like, protecting you from something or making a certain decision based off of, like, a fear that is maybe not actually still there.
Yeah.
But when you went through the thing or when that part went through that thing, it's still functioning as it's stuck back in that time where it needs to, like, defend itself or do whatever it is doing, you know, however it's showing up in your system.
Yeah. So, you know, speaking of the moments at which we incur trauma, one of the things that grounds the entire book is the way that you and your family are forced to react to some trauma that you experience early in your life, very early, like 4 years old. Do you feel comfortable about talking about that with me today?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's interesting, like, as you start, this is one of the first, you know, really in-depth conversations that I've had around the book, and it's interesting, I just noticed, like, such a, just, like, swell of, just, like, emotion in my chest. It's, like, just such a surreal feeling to be, to have this moment be here. Yeah, I do, and if I feel like it takes me outside of my window of tolerance, I will let you know.
Okay, that's good, that's good. So, I don't want to give away the whole book to folks that haven't gotten it yet because they should get it and read it, but describe to the best you can in a way that makes sense what you went through at the age of four and how it affected you.
So, great question.
Yes, okay.
Basically, I was – I think that a lot of children will – you know, experiment and will, and there's a lot of like different things that children do. And I think that there's like a certain, you know, like window for like what is like considered, you know, normal and like what is normal anyway.
You discover bodies and other bodies when you're a kid.
Exactly. But I did have an experience, a repeated experience in a relationship with someone who was significantly older than me that I was introduced to in and around a church setting. So it was like a trusted family friend who, you know, groomed me and, you know, essentially put me into a position where I was being sexually abused by someone who was older than me and not really realizing that that was what that was called. I didn't really understand, like, what, you know, was happening.
How much older was he?
He was significantly older in the interest of, you know, protecting.
Yes, sir. Oh, gotcha.
Like, you know, I mean, they weren't someone who was, like, over 18.
Okay.
It was someone who – but it was also someone who was much older than me.
Yeah, not near 4 years old, the age that you were.
Right.
Yeah.
It was something that has, you know, colored my life in so many ways and has affected me in so many ways. But it's really common. And I think that especially for, you know, male survivors of sexual abuse, I think that it is – stigmatized in a different way, and there's like a different amount of shame that's associated with it, and it's not, you know, more severe or less severe. I think that all sexual abuse and sexual assault is horrific. Yeah. I just, when you're a child and your world is colored in those colors, when you're not ready to understand what those colors are, I just think that it just creates just like a harder road to navigate, yeah, like your relationship with yourself.
Yeah, yeah. You're so brave to share this story. You know, it's different to talk about this kind of thing when it feels appropriate with people you know and love, or to maybe mention it casually in one episode of your show. But you've written this in a book now, which means that people will be reading about this for some time over many different iterations. And you'll be doing a lot of interviews like this with me where you'll be asked to talk about it again. That takes a lot of bravery. So first, I commend you for that. But secondly, I want to ask, and I was thinking the whole time, like, this is traumatic. Like, was there ever a version of this book in which you didn't share the abuse?
No. Mm. And I think part of this book was, there was a piece of it where, like, I wanted to write about this because I feel like I have always felt my whole life, even as a small child, that like a sense of like wanting to make sure that other kids didn't go through some of the things that I went through. And I remember having that feeling of wanting to help other kids and other people from a very young age. And I also talk about in the book that I thought that I was going to be like a really cute like yoga studio that maybe would have like a salon in it where you could get like blow dries and fierce like scones and like flatbread and stuff. I didn't realize that it would be like a book. But I have wanted, you know, the spirit of like wanting to help and wanting to learn and wanting to be able to like process what my purpose in life is and where I was born into. There was also another facet to this book where I wanted to do it for me. Like, I wanted to heal for me. I wanted to, like, kind of, it was almost like this, the act of writing this book, I wanted to get it out of my system almost. And as you were saying that, I was like, I guess it didn't really totally occur to me that I was going to be doing so many interviews, like, when I was in the process of doing it. I was like, oh man. But no, I think the sooner that you can talk about it, I think that the less it can kind of wreak havoc in your life. And so I think that for people that have went through something like this, I want them to know that it doesn't have to, you know, ruin your life. You don't have to develop self-destructive behaviors that will, you know, throw your life into disarray. Yeah. And I, you know, wanted to be able to share that.
Yeah.
Coming up, JVN on his cats and his love for Sister Act 2.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Hero Bread. Burger buns, tortillas, and fluffy breads, and oh, so many carbs. Hero Bread makes healthier versions of these carb favorites. Fewer calories, 0 to 2 grams net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, great taste. With more of the dietary fiber and protein you want with no compromise. Don't skip out on your favorites. Just use Hero Bread. Get 10% off your order at hero.co with code HEROPOD at checkout. That's HEROPOD at HERO.CO.
Maddie Sofia here, host of Shortwave, the daily science podcast from NPR. Listen for new discoveries, everyday mysteries, and the science behind the headlines, all in about 10 minutes every weekday. It's a great addition to your daily listening, whether you're a science nerd or, you know, just a little science curious. Subscribe now to Shortwave from NPR.
Describe for folks that haven't read about you yet, young JVN, because he was something to behold. He seemed like a just delight.
Well, I was a lot of fun. You know, I still am.
Yes.
I was basically just like a geode obsessed stamp collecting, rock collecting, like lover of figure skating, obsessed with gymnastics, kind of exactly how I am now, but
yeah,
like young. And I had like really cute, like really wide space teeth. And I had not found my patience and resolve to like have long hair yet. And also like my mom was forcing me to get haircuts every 4 weeks at Mastercuts, which was like a travesty in and of itself. I think my life, when I think about it, has been full of extremes.
Mm.
I think as dark as the dark times were has been as light as the light have been. Mm. It's like equal and opposite reaction style or something. So yeah, I did have a lot of fun. And my mom is like, we had a lot of fun.
Your mom seems so cool.
Yeah, my mom is like, she is a...
like a ride or die, you know, mom.
She is a ride or die mom. She's ass deep in cats in my apartment in New York as we speak. Yeah, she has been raising like my poor like 1-year-old kitten, Liza Mianelli, who survived Pan Luke, which is like this kitten virus that kills like 80 to 90% of kittens that get it. It's kind of like parvo for puppies.
Oh, no.
And the kittens that survive it will oftentimes get like really horrific stomach issues because of like all the antibiotics and all the medicine that they have to take to like treat it. So I was like literally, well, first it was like kitten diarrhea leakage. And I was like, what is this? I don't understand.
Yeah.
That progressed to me waking up like to this cat having full.
Oh, no.
Diarrhea BMs, like on my comforter, on my chest, on my pillows,
Jonathan.
like in the middle of the night, like 2 a.m, just waking up to a sick earthen kitten.
Poor baby.
It was like so expensive to keep her in New York City. So then I called the vet in Kansas City and I was like, oh my God, will you help me? Like, I can't lose another kitten right now.
Your mom stepped in.
No, I took her to the vet, like back in Kansas City. I had to like fly her to Kansas City.
Oh my God.
Covered in diarrhea. Get her to the
You
the
had
vet
this diarrhea cat on the plane?
She was in Kansas City from December to April with the vet. We finally got her diet like stabilized, figured it out. This IBS like case was horrific, but now she's got thick, solid, great poop, and she's ready to go. Now my mom flew her to New York City this past Friday, and she's reunited with Harry Larry the weatherman and Matilda and Genevieve, who with my Charlotte Webb rule, which is like if I have a cat pass away, I get 2 new cats so as to not like fall into like a horrific losing your cat depression.
Yeah.
And then like Bug the Second had like a horrific, I had like a cat tragedy this summer while I was filming Queer Eye. And so then I like very like, you know, height of extremes, like went straight to the pound and like adopted 2 kittens that like same day, like while hyperventilating, like crying, holding kittens. And, like, my assistant was, like, telling the lady at, like, the animal shelter that, like, I am not as crazy as I look. And, so now I have 4 cats, and my mom is totally, like, introducing Liza to the other 3 this weekend in New York City.
Oh, my goodness.
And now I have 4 cats, and I just really need all these cats to, like, hold it together.
Yeah, because you have a busy life. Shout out to your mom. She just steps in and gets it done.
Thank God. Thank you, Mom, if you're listening to this, RN.
Yes. I want to go back to you as a kid.
Yes, please.
It's obvious from the start that you love your mother and she means so much to you and she would do the world for you, and she has. But I loved the way that the relationship between you and your stepdad unfolded. You began when he entered the picture being very skeptical of him, and he ends up being this wonderful man who was totally accepting of the JVN who is gay and who expresses himself differently and who wants to be a male cheerleader. Like, he's never making you not feel like you are part of the family. And you draw really close to him in a way that surprised me after how he was introduced. What can you say about Steve for us, for folks that haven't read the book yet?
I think he is probably one of the most important and formative people of my life.
Mm.
When someone, like, takes you on as their own when you're not, you know, biologically their own, I think is really special. Like, Steve didn't have to raise me like he wanted to.
Mm.
I don't even know who I would be if not for my relationship with him.
Yeah.
Because he really kind of showed me the ability of people to heal.
Mm.
And that your past doesn't have to be your future. Mm. And so, yeah, he was just such an incredible teacher.
Yeah. Were you surprised by how kind he was to you when he entered the picture? You know, you are...
No!
Yeah, well, because I think for me, like, when I was a kid, you know, figuring out how to be gay, your default assumption would be that any new male figure that entered your life would be either inherently skeptical of you or dismissive of you because of how you expressed yourself.
No,
mm.
That was not my experience with Steve. Or like I was like, you should be wooing me over. I'm your biggest obstacle to the okay. I didn't know that that's what it was back then, but I was like, I saw Parent Trap. I saw It Takes Two. Those were very popular at the time. And I was like, no, Meredith. So, no, I didn't. I felt like, no. I was like, you better be nice to me. And to be clear, Steve was very much a father figure, like, prior to them getting married. I mean, I felt like he owed me something, and he made it very clear that he did not. And that he was, you know, like, I had an expectation of how that relationship was going to be. And he was like, son. And that's exactly how he would have said it. Like, son, like, that is not what we're going to do here.
Yeah.
It would have been, you know, very similar to those words.
What you write in the book, the two of y'all, when you were a kid, he'd be driving you around somewhere, going somewhere, and y'all would sing together, like belt songs in the car. What songs would y'all belt?
Well, Steve was really into Les Mis. He was also into Miss Saigon.
Okay.
Also, Sister Act 2.
Yes.
I think we both blew out several capillaries in our eyes trying to sing His Eyes on the Sparrow,
oh my
Honey.
God.
Joyful, Joyful was very big for us.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sister Act 2 was really a big deal.
It's still a big deal.
Yeah.
If you want to
really
be somebody,
is.
If you want to go somewhere.
Sister, can we spice this up a little bit?
Yes.
Sure, if you think you can.
Oh, my God, yes.
If you want to be somebody.
Yes, so good.
If you want to go somewhere. That's such a classic.
Yes, yes. So you talk a lot in the book about how from an early age you start taking part in some not so good behaviors to cope with some of the trauma. I'm talking specifically about sexual habits and drug use. And one, I appreciate your candor in all of that because you shared stuff you didn't have to share, but you shared stuff that a lot of people are probably dealing with. When did you feel like you were ready to write those things down? Because, I mean, this is serious drug use, serious, you know, sexual habits that weren't productive for you. It was heavy. When did you know that you could say that and share it?
Well, having Queer Eye become a success in it, giving me the platform that it's given me.
Yeah.
The desire for me to want to share about my experiences in those realms became stronger over time. There are so many young people that are struggling with what I struggled with. Mm. And, you know, my way is, like, not the way or, like, or the most gorgeous way. And it definitely has had its, like, down points. But I think that the point of what the book is, back to that elevator pitch, is that, like, no matter how far off course you have gotten and no matter how, you know, f***ed up you feel, there is a way to get to a life that is fulfilling and sustainable and that you feel good about, and that in a world where you can love and forgive yourself for everything that has happened for you to get to that particular darkness in your life. And the other thing is that, like, that experience, like, is not a light bulb. And I think that so many times when we are in a f***ed up situation, we're looking for that one definitive moment where, like, you turn a corner and, like, oh my God, it's not bad anymore. And in my experience, it has never been that. It has always been three steps forward, two steps back, three steps. And it's more of like that harm reduction model, which I also talk about in the book.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even I, like, in the darkest of my dark times, like, I definitely didn't see this particular path presenting itself when I did, like, and I say this in the book, like, I just wanted to, like, be self-sufficient and never have to borrow money from my parents.
Yeah.
Because, God, my parents are about borrowing money.
But they were helpful, I will say, when I was
reading. But you know what? I gave them a nice polish on that shit. I did. I was
ultimately
a good son.
Yes,
I was a good good person, good child. And
but there were some moments where I was like, Mama swooped in and helped.
She did.
She helped.
I wouldn't be here without her for that, you know. But she also didn't let me forget it, okay? And as she's sitting here with my cats, she, you know, so we love so much.
I love it. Yeah.
Up next, JVN on living with HIV. And learning how to live his best life.
Every time you drive your car, have a package delivered, or get on a plane, you're polluting the climate. But it doesn't have to be that way.
Nature is powerful. Why don't we use it to our advantage?
Meet the people working on cleaner ways to get around on Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR. Transportation Climate Solutions on Here and Now Anytime, wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you've never donated to the NPR network before, that's okay. Public radio is available to everyone for free. But we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters for Public Media Giving Days, coming up on May 1st and 2nd. Please give at donate.npr.org, and thank you.
And talking specifically about the part of the book where you're expressing how these dueling problems of drugs and sex compulsion lead you to a dark place. What was the darkest moment there and then? There were a few that I read in the book, but, like, when was a moment where you're like, these drugs are ruining me, this sex and the way I treat sex is ruining me? Was there, like, a dark moment where you said, okay, we have to begin to dig ourselves out of this hole?
Well, I think, like, collapsing on my face in the middle of highlights and getting diagnosed with HIV the next day was a pretty, like, clear indicator.
Set up that scene for folks that haven't read it yet.
Yeah, well, so my stepdad, you know, after... I mean, it's a long book. It's a long story. And I feel like it doesn't really do it justice to sensationalize it.
I don't want to give a short shrift at all, for sure.
Yeah. So it's like in my early 20s, I developed a sexual compulsivity that I think was pretty directly linked to the abuse and secrecy around my abuse, you know, developed in kind of coming into like a very high stress job and being very young. And that was kind of where the pressure showed itself. Mm. And in that time... You know, meth is a very common and not very much talked about drug that is, you know, both abused in homosexual circles, but also heterosexual circles. Yeah. And it is a very, like, pervasive, wide-ranging problem that, you know, ruins people's lives all the time in really high numbers that we just don't really talk about as much. I don't even want to say, like, an exact number because I can't think of it, but I definitely was not someone who was, like, you know, doing meth on, like, a daily basis. Yeah. I was someone who would have, you know, weeks of time of not doing it, and then I would do it for, like, 2 days and then have more weeks and then not. So it's not all people that are abusing meth look like people that are on the billboards that you think about that would be doing meth. And in gay sex culture, there is definitely a huge meth epidemic that's a really big problem. I was introduced to meth, like, not from me finding it, but from, like, going home with someone who was doing it and not really putting, you know, two and two together. Yeah. And I think that's another, like, insidious piece of it is, like, you can – I definitely never saw myself as someone who would, like, ever do meth. Really, I think it's, like, don't ever do it. Don't ever try it. If you go home with someone who has it, like, put your shoes on and get the out of there. Like, there's, it's really not that chic to try it.
Yeah.
Like, if you really want to see, like, the ugliest parts of your soul, try meth. And if you're thinking to yourself, like, duh, of course, it's like, but, you know, you never know what you're going to do, like, when you watch your dad die in your living room or when you have survived all, I mean, people do things when they've been through things that you might just, you just don't know that you would ever do that.
Yeah.
And when, you know, watching my stepdad lose his battle to cancer and, you know, dying in our living room in hospice care, like at 25 years old, like that me right on up. And it took me.
Of course it did.
And it took me a long time to, and also at that same time, which we also haven't talked about, you know, as I was realizing that I had this issue of sexual compulsivity and I was, you know, dealing with like incapacitating flashbacks of my sexual abuse. Mm. In and around, like, work and, you know, these current sexual acting out behaviors that were going on back at the time. Like, I was like, oh, God, like, this is really not normal. Like, what is this? Like, what is happening to me? And the therapist that I had at the time, we did kind of go to that antidepressant route. Mm. And I thought at the time being, like, you know, 24 years old, 23 years old, like, oh, if I take these, like, I'll just stop wanting to hurt myself. Mm. And when I realized that being on antidepressants, like, didn't cure my self-destructive behavior, my gut reaction was like, well, I'm just not going to take these anymore. And so then I kind of just stopped taking them. And that was really that sort of...
Then it got really dark.
Yeah.
Mm. So then all of these things are happening. You end up not knowing you have HIV. You're doing hair one day at the salon. You pass out. When you wake up, what is the first thing you think?
Oh, my God, her highlights. And then I was like, where am I? Like, I was like, who are these people and where am I?
Wow.
And, but then I was like, but girl, you've done really, like, high-risk things before and, like, kind of, you know, didn't, it, you know, it, you didn't get it. So maybe, like, you, maybe this is just, like, really the flu and you just need to go to bed. And so I was hoping.
But then. You know, I really appreciated once you shared that and news of your diagnosis, you took several pages to let people know the ins and outs of HIV and what it means to be on medication and what it means to be undetectable and what it means to be on PrEP, because a lot of folks still don't know. Like, they don't know.
It's a really alarming amount of ignorance around living with HIV.
Yeah.
Like, just a few months ago, a really close family friend asked me if she could contract HIV from sharing a joint with me.
Oh, my God.
I've known this person my entire life.
I'm so sorry.
And with a completely straight face.
Ugh.
Like literally asking the question.
How do you react in those moments?
That was not my best reaction that particular moment. I really took that moment to lean into that particular person's really problematic political affiliations and really went the f*** off.
Okay.
But, you know, other times I've had more grace. But yeah, it's hard. It's really, it's like when George H.W. Bush died, that was hard. Like seeing people, yes, like seeing people champion leaders that had a first front row seat to one of the biggest losses of American life in this country's history.
The AIDS crisis.
The inaction of the Reagan administration and the Bush administration, I think, is part of why I was even able to be exposed to HIV. If they had gotten on top of this in the 80s and 90s, we could have stopped. With what we know now about the spread of HIV, we could have had these treatments so much sooner had the American government not been an immovable block to research. And to be clear, that is what happened.
And then also we see right now this really best of times, worst of times when it comes to treating and preventing HIV. There are some people that live in certain parts of the country where you can get the drugs you need and the care you need pretty easily and or cheaply. And there are other parts of the country, like the American South, where if you're a gay man, particularly a gay man of color, your likelihood of just getting the virus is so, so high because of a lot of factors. Stigma around you, lack of access to the healthcare you need. It's really a crazy time just talking about
even just
AIDS
like,
writ large because it's so so disparate.
Yes. I mean, even the year that I – or the 4 months that I spent in Atlanta shooting Queer Eye, I went to a walk-in when I was there because I felt like I was having symptoms of something and I could not – even talk to the person that took me in. They had no ability to speak to LGBTQ.
Really?
Yes. Like not male-on-male anal sex, not male-on-male oral sex. And all of these things have to be able to be spoken about. Like you have to be able to look at your medical provider and say like,
here's what I've been doing.
Participate in this, that, whatever, and not be seen as, you should not be shamed for your sexuality, for your gender, for how you present in your gender, for how you who you choose to engage in sex with. You have to be able to be honest with your medical care providers.
Yeah, yeah. I want to talk. I'm realizing now our time's almost up, but we haven't talked yet about Queer Eye.
Let's talk about Queer Eye.
Let's talk about Queer Eye. One, you say this in the book, like you and everyone else was surprised by how big it's been. But like really, how surprised are you by how much everyone loves this show?
I get asked that question a lot. But being in this NPR studio, I'm going to like try not to have a nervous breakdown saying it. I came here to do an interview here for Gay of Thrones. Like, this is the first place I ever came to do a radio interview.
Really? NPR West in LA.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. It's okay.
I know. I recognize myself.
Yeah.
Now, but like my life is crazy.
Yeah.
I have turned down opportunities this week to be able to be in like a stable and self-care place to be able to like, you know, to do these interviews and to talk about this book.
Yeah.
You know, everything that I talk about in the book is like, I went through all of that. And so for someone that's went through all of that, to balance like this much scrutiny and pressure now, like, you know, fundamentally, like not that much time later.
Yeah.
And it's been years, but it's like, you know, I'm still someone who has survived this trauma and I'm still someone who, you know, has endured these things, but come out the other side stronger. But like, I can't believe that I'm on NPR, like, talking about these, like, things to you right now. And I lived in, like, a one-bedroom apartment that, like, I couldn't afford, like, a block away from this place. And I am happy, and I could have never have seen, like, how much success that Queer Eye would have. You know, I believe in myself, and I believe in the book, and I believe in, you know, everything that Queer Eye has done. But, like, I'm super uncomfortable, and I am, you know, and I'm scared. So it's, like, I am really grateful for the success, and I hope that I don't have any nervous breakdowns on this book tour.
No, you are. You're just, I mean, like, every moment in which you expose more of yourself and share more of your story in the public eye, it just helps people know that they aren't alone in their struggles. So you know this already, but so many people just appreciate you being unafraid to be the complete you in the public eye. I appreciate it.
Well, I think that's the great lie, right? It's like, who said I'm not afraid?
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah.
I am afraid.
Yeah.
Like, every time I leave my house in my normal clothes, I'm, like, afraid. Like, I have to, like, look behind me, make sure there's, like, no one that's going to, like, scream faggot or, like, you know, try to do something to me. Like, people that don't present as cisgender people, like, it's more of, like, being brave enough to, like, say that you're afraid. And I might look confident. I do not always feel confident, but I never said that I always felt confident.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes you confident.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do want to ask one question about the show.
Sure.
I've watched all of them. I interviewed Karamo a few months ago. All y'all are just such fun interviews and delightful human beings. But I notice on the show, y'all don't really go too far into politics. And the Fab Five helps people on the right and the left. The motto for the show, or at least one of the mottos, has been turning red states pink, one makeover at a time. But in that vein, some of your episodes have gotten flack for maybe being too nice to some people who actually might hold anti-LGBT or racist views. You've heard this critique before, but, like, what do you say when critics knock the Fab Five for that?
Well, I would say that for me, I can only speak for myself because, like, I don't cast the show. None of us cast the show.
Yeah.
And I know that we've all have had our own feelings of resistance around working with some of the people who have been cast on the show for, you know, to be heroes.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, all of that has been on camera and you've seen what those resistances and what those issues were. I have had to hold space and be in the same room with people that were, you know, and are fully Trump supportive, do not understand the concept of white privilege. I don't think that they would define themselves as racist, but I think that they have a complicated relationship with white privilege and a complicated relationship with taking ownership of what white privilege has done in this country and the history of the fact that, like, this country's financial system and the wealth that this country was built on was, like, built on the physical labor of, like, slavery.
Yeah.
And without slavery, like, America as we know it, like, wouldn't look how it does.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one issue.
Yes.
So on the other side of things.
Yes.
I am able to put myself into this, like, you know, disassociative state where I can, like, choose not to look at people's political affiliations, just focus on their fugly haircut or their problematic skin or whatever, because I know about hair and skin and I can try to connect and help because that's what my job is there for.
Yeah.
On that show to do that.
Yeah.
And through approaching those people with some amount of compassion and love and curiosity, there is a potential that their views could shift.
Mm.
So I do think that there's something to be said for approaching people with some sort of, like, compassion and curiosity.
Yeah.
But I guess what I would say to those critics is that, like, I understand.
Mm.
Because that family friend that said that thing to me about the joint, it is hard for me that that is a family friend. It is hard for me that my family wants to associate with that family. It is hard for me that I have to share space with that person and that I'm encouraged to be around with someone who fundamentally cannot understand my plight and my experience in the world because of the ignorance that was in their question.
Mm.
But I do think that ignorance is really pervasive.
Yes,
but I have never met anyone who changed an ignorant person's heart and mind with venom.
There you go. That's it. A question I thought long and hard about as I was finishing your book yesterday. I wondered and wondered and wondered what Steve would make of you now, your stepdad, who passed away and who was always so in your corner. If you could talk to him today and he could talk to you today, what do you think would be the first thing y'all would say to each other?
That was a really rude question. I think I would just say how much I miss him.
What would he say?
Well, if he was immediately downloaded on the events of the last 6 years, he probably would say something like, that's bad to the bone was his very favorite phraseology because he, you know, was just really peaking in the 90s. And so, yeah, I think he would be really blown away, though. I think he'd be very proud.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he'd be really proud.
He should be. He should be very proud of you. Jonathan, I'm so grateful for you and the light that you shine into the world. And I'm grateful for your candor and honesty. And I really do feel like I've just had a wonderful therapy session right now. You have brightened my day more than you know.
Oh, my God. Thank you. That lets me know that you should probably make an appointment with your real therapist, like stat. So
we're overdue for a visit. I've been traveling for the last 2 weeks, and I'm like, if I don't see this man soon,
get on some self-care, queen. If yes. I'm sounding like therapy to you, that means you need to see your therapist.
It's been 2 weeks, so he is due for me in that chair. Very
Thanks
soon.
So much for your time. It was really good
Thank
to talk.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks again to Queer Eye's Jonathan Van Ness. He is up for an Emmy for the show this year. In the feed right now are a bunch of conversations with some really great performers, also up for Emmys. All right, this episode was produced by Anjali Sastry and edited by Alexander McCall. There was additional production and editing by Liam McBain and Jordana Hochman. All right, listeners, don't forget, this Friday we are back with another episode. And for that one, we want you to share the best thing that happened to you all week. You can record yourself whenever you want at any point throughout any week. Send us that file to samsanders@npr.org. All right, till Friday, be good to yourselves. As always, thanks for listening. I'm Sam Sanders. We'll talk soon.
Across America, history is often recorded on small markers. You've probably seen them on the sides of roads, in front of buildings, in the middle of nowhere. NPR's Laura Sullivan spent a year investigating thousands of markers and found a distorted version of America's history, but also curiosities, humor, and joy. Listen to the new episode of The Sunday Story on the Up First podcast from NPR.
In this country, more than 2 local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
The Indicator from Planet Money is all in on video games. Not just because they're a fun hobby. Video games are one of the fastest growing businesses worldwide, worth more than the film and music industries combined.
We're seeing some games that are really taking, $500 million to make.
We're taking a week-long look at the video game industry. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.